Hey everyone out there, and thanks again for joining us here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. Every month at ASAP Now, we feature something from you on the podcast, either from the magazine or special for our listeners only. And this month, we are back to our core, clinical medicine. Now, in emergency medicine, we see tons of patients in all sorts of states of life, and a state that we all know, that we all even rely on as a species, is pregnancy. Now, pregnancy comes with all sorts of complications. It's why there's literally an entire specialty dedicated to it and why they see their patients so often during pregnancy. But we'd be remiss if we didn't know how to take care of those patients and their passengers in a pinch. We had a great article in this month's magazine, Code Eclampsia, which is a review of one of the biggest pregnancy emergencies. And we're featuring its author right here. Check it out. Hey everyone at ASAP Now, thanks again for joining us. This month I have with us Dr. Polly Wiltz, who is president-elect of EMRA and also an emergency medicine attending in Washington with a really interesting clinical topic. So Polly, thanks again so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, the topic, spoiler alert, is eclampsia. And I actually love this clinical topic. We don't see it a whole lot, but man, when we see it, it is a big deal. So you submitted for us an article on eclampsia management, which is running in the magazine this month. But I wanted to hear from you, like, what made you want to write this article?
I have a lot of experience in women's reproductive health in general, that sort of originated in my background before I pursued medical school and did a lot of education and maternal and infant health when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nicaragua back in 2015 through 2018. And I think that passion for just education surrounding reproductive health and reproductive rights has sort of followed me throughout my career. And a lot of that has sort of transcended into the projects that I'm interested in. And I have a really close relationship, or I guess I did before I graduated my residency, with some of the OBs who trained me at my residency program. And I think education that I received for them was just sort of how I became passionate about putting out op-eds and articles discussing these topics, because it's so important to make sure that not only physicians, but patients can identify the warning signs for some of these disease processes that can affect pregnant patients.
Yeah. And I love that, because it's like pregnancy, it's something humanity has to go through to continue as a species. But it's also kind of a life threatening status. So I wanted to start with, like, what is eclampsia? Like, very specifically, I feel like there is a lot of interchangeable use of preeclampsia and eclampsia. And you actually do a really great job defining either of them. Could you share it with our listeners?
Sure. Preeclampsia and eclampsia are one and the same. I would basically say that eclampsia is the most severe form of preeclampsia. And so preeclampsia is a very serious pregnancy-related condition, and it falls under the umbrella of our gestational hypertensive disorders. And there's a couple of specific side effects that women can develop within this disease process, one being hypertension, and then you have to have one of two additional categories being protein in the urine or any signs of end organ dysfunction. And that's why we're so hyper focused on what a pregnant patient's blood pressure is, because that often is the only warning sign that a patient might be either predisposed or in preeclampsia. And if we don't catch those warning signs early, what can happen is preeclampsia will essentially develop into eclampsia, where you have end organ damage specifically to the brain and you develop seizures. And that is life-threatening. It can cause irreversible brain damage. It can cause spontaneous hemorrhage, because we are also, as a pregnant patient, in like a hypercoagulable state. And there's a lot of physiological changes that can have a lot of negative outcomes. And so everyone's really hyper-focused on preeclampsia, because the worst thing that can happen is progression to eclampsia, where you have all of these other issues. It could be edema of the lungs, so difficulty breathing. It could be severe hypertension. It could be kidney failure. It could be liver failure. Plus, you've then progressed to a seizure, it's pretty difficult to control in these patients until you deliver the baby, which is why it's so scary.
Absolutely. And I think what you really bring out here is the end organ dysfunction. Like, not only is it hypertension, but it's hypertension with proteinuria or end organ dysfunction. And in your article, you march out what the specifics of that are, like HELP and so on. But I did want to highlight that you listed visual disturbances, which makes sense, but then also new onset headache. And I think that's an interesting one, because in the management of a non-pregnant hypertensive patient, we're like, headache, like, you're probably fine. It's probably not a hypertensive emergency. Can you tell me a little bit more about the headache part of, you know, of how that dovetails in as an organ dysfunction for preeclampsia?
It's such a difficult symptom to suss out, I think, too, in pregnant patients, because headaches happen for a variety of reasons. They can happen and resolve on their own. But in this patient population specifically, if a pregnant patient comes into my ED and they are 20 weeks and greater, and they're complaining of a new headache and they don't usually get headaches, it might not be the worst headache, you know, that thunderclap where we are chasing, you know, concerns for like a subarachnoid, but they're concerned enough about it that they come in and they don't necessarily have any medical history, I'm going to work that up and check their urine studies and check a chemistry on them to make sure that there's not any other sneaky warning signs that are developing. Because if their blood pressure is controlled by medication, yet they're still having symptoms, that to me is something worth ruling out to make sure that, one, we can treat the headache, make the patient feel better, but that this isn't like the canary in the coal mine that is leading to worsening outcomes, because it's that first early symptom.
And I think my takeaway listening to you is that this is just such a bad thing to miss. Probably overcalling is better than undercalling here. Is that somewhat accurate? Like, go looking on this particular condition.
I 100% would recommend that, especially in pregnant patients, especially in our current climate where we don't always know what the access to like OB related healthcare is. If somebody's coming from a more rural area and they're, you know, traveling hours to see you because you're the nearest emergency department and it's for a headache, that person is going to take up a little bit more of my time, and I'm going to dedicate a little bit more of my like cognitive process to that person to make sure that I am not missing anything in the event that they are safe to go home, because what does their follow-up look like? So all of those things are sort of filtering through my head when I take care of these patients.
Yeah, and what's their prenatal care status? I think these are all really good points here. And again, it's funny because pregnancy is so common, but it is like kind of a really dangerous state to be in. And there's a lot of complications that can happen. So I would love to hear you walk us through the management, because I think the diagnosis part, we all have a heightened sensitivity when we see a pregnant patient who is hypertensive. What is the management if it's actually eclampsia though?
If it is actually eclampsia, and I have seen one case in my very short career, and it was probably this, you know, in the top five of scary cases, because it can just go poorly so quickly. But the first and most important step is to stop the seizure. And while traditionally in the emergency department, we think benzos, in pregnant patients, if you haven't started magnesium, that is first-line therapy for an eclamptic seizure. And there's a couple different ways that you can administer it. You can do an IV if you're fortunate enough to have IV access. But if you don't, you can also do intramuscular. And the dosing is a little bit different depending, again, on which route you're administering it. So if you have IV, it's a big dose, 4 to 6 grams IV, you push it quickly over 20 minutes, and then you can put them on a maintenance dose of about 1 to 2 grams over an hour, and you continue that until either seizures are controlled or until they can be transferred to a labor and delivery unit or an OR to have the placenta delivered, because unfortunately that is the definitive management of eclampsia, is the delivery of the placenta. If you don't have IV access, your other option is intramuscular. You give a total of 10 grams and you do 5 milligrams in each glute muscle, which I have not seen, but that is
big
your
dose.
Sort of next line
that
of
defense. That's a big dose.
It is a big dose because you want to make sure that you absorb it. And so that is step number one. Usually that is sufficient to get the seizure under control, but in severe cases, if for whatever reason magnesium isn't working, then you sort of proceed down the pathway of regular seizure control, keeping in mind what medications are safe in pregnancy. Most of them are, but you know, lorazepam or diazepam are available in every emergency department. I think either one of those medications would be reasonable. And depending on which one you pick, there's a dosing specific. And again, if you don't have IV access, 10 milligrams of Versed intramuscular is the dose to go to. If the patient is still seizing, which I hope at that point it's not, then you can consider keproloading the patient. And you can do a max of up to 4,500 milligrams. And there's also fosphenytoin. And again, that really is just dependent on what you have access to in your emergency department. I'm sure it's more easily attainable at, you know, a level one trauma facility, but versus like a critical access, it might be a little bit variable. And this is the area where if we're getting into a third line agent, that we need to be considering airway protection, because all of these medications can have pretty significant sedating effects. But also, if you're just not successful, propofol works wonders in aborting seizures. And so considering establishing a definitive airway and initiating propofol. And then at that point, I think not only do you want to have OB on the phone, but touching base with neurology and an intensivist to kind of make sure that this patient is getting all the care that they need for this particular process.
And I will say, I think one of the tough things here is that eclampsia is certainly a disease of pregnancy, but also of the postpartum state. And if a patient is seizing and it's a young woman, and let's say she's postpartum, because eclampsia can happen like 6 to 12 weeks after, they don't exactly look like they just had a baby. So here, is it fair to say that our seizure management, like benzos and AEDs, will not be the wrong answer? It's that until we get the additional history of, hey, you're postpartum, or that you're pregnant, we just couldn't tell, that we just won't get to the MAG and OB side. So it's a question to always ask of a childbearing female.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to start with your sort of standard seizure abortion pathway. And then if you discover that information along the way, add magnesium in. And you might, I personally haven't experienced that, where you start with, you know, the sort of benzos and then learn that you need mag later. But I haven't seen any literature that shows that it's inappropriate if you learn after the fact. Because again, mag will help, but getting the seizure under control is the most important. And all of these medications in conjecture at the end of the day is what stops the patient from seizing.
Yeah, and I've been lucky enough to have this exact case. This was my first eclampsia case. As a young lady was seizing, we did everything that we thought we could in terms of seizure. We're on our like third AED, intubated her, put her on propofol. And then imagine this, husband walks in with a tiny baby in a car seat. And we were like, oh my God, like this is eclampsia. And found out she was, I think it was like 8 weeks or so postpartum. So it didn't really look postpartum. But I think this is the zinger of eclampsia that I think is so fascinating. Now I've been really lucky to always work at highly resourced emergency departments, but I am cognizant that, you know, not every hospital has OB services. Like, we know boarding is a huge issue. We know that if you need to transfer out, like that could be days. So we hope we don't have to sit on the eclamptic patient in the ED. But walk me through, you know, the management of eclampsia beyond the initial MAG and, you know, so on, in terms of, you know, what if we have this patient for a few hours? Because sometimes we will, like, we can't just always ship them out if we don't have the resources to.
Wouldn't it be nice to have an auto launch for eclamptic patients like we do in some of our other situations? But that's a really good point, like especially in more rural settings or areas where there just isn't access to tertiary level care. I think similar to any, well, maybe not similar, but I think the things that I would focus on is, you know, stabilizing the patient. So once you've addressed sort of the ABCs and you know you're going to be sitting with them for a while, what are the next things I need to be thinking about? One is like a stat head CT. Make sure that this seizure didn't cause a spontaneous hemorrhage in the brain, because that would dictate, you know, different interventions. I would be reviewing blood work, looking at electrolytes, making sure that there's any, deficits that need to be addressed. What does the kidney function look like? What's the hypertension? Does this patient need a cardine drip or nifedipine or labetalol to help keep blood pressures under control? And then you have to be careful with the magnesium too, because there is such a thing as too much. I mean, we can give too much of anything. And so making sure that I'm checking my magnesium levels, within an appropriate time frame. So these are patients that even if you have sort of gotten out of the red zone and stabilized them and stopped the seizure, the work doesn't stop there because they have such a high risk for clinical decompensation. So really it is ICU level critical care that you're providing for these patients until they can be transferred or evaluated or, taken to the OR for definitive management.
Yeah, it's a scary situation. Like, what can we do? Something about it feels dissatisfying that you have a patient you know needs the baby out and you can't get the baby out in these situations. But I think your management pearls are certainly extremely helpful. What are some takeaways you have? Just like a couple takeaways you have for just, an ER doctor who, again, probably doesn't stumble across this diagnosis very often, just doesn't happen that often, I think, at least not in the emergency department. Like, what are a couple takeaways you want them to have after reading your article and listening to this podcast?
If the patient comes in and their past viability, so 22 weeks or so and on, and they have hypertension plus any of the symptoms that I sort of listed, but especially sneaky symptoms like a headache or intermittent blurry vision, keep a wide differential and make sure that you're working them up completely, because that might lead you to preventing them from progressing into full eclampsia. And I think the other takeaway is don't forget about postpartum patients, because those are the ones that you can unintentionally forget to ask about if they've, been pregnant or recently, or if they've had a child recently, and you're doing all this work and you're not getting good seizure control. It might just lower the alarm bells in your head a little bit, like knowing, similar to your story, that, oh yeah, well, that would make sense. Let's give some mag. And then magnesium and OB early, getting OB on the phone early and making sure that you have some help, so that whether you need to transfer, whether you need to get them to the OR, that these patients have the specialist help that they need as soon as possible.
I love it. Dr. Wiltz, the article was sweet. It was concise. It told us what we needed to know. I love how you think about how to manage eclampsia and just, do these things. I want to really appreciate you and say thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for reviewing my article and letting me talk about it. I could talk about it all day.
Special thanks to Dr. Wiltz for both the article and her time on the podcast, and also your passion for women's health. And of course, thanks to you all, our listeners, for tuning in. There is tons more in the magazine this month on the website, asapnow.com, with some of my favorite articles being one about drug pipeline and what's coming for emergency medicine with Dr. Rudecki, a great summary on AI scribes, which if you are not using them, you probably will be in the upcoming couple of years, and it's pretty incredible. There's a great opinion piece on climate change and how it affects what we see in terms of public health, and a clinical favorite, Problem Solvers, with our own associate editor, Dr. Marco, on nail bed injuries. And of course, much, much more. Remember, the digital edition is on the website on even months, with the print in your mailboxes at home on the odd months. So this month, check us out, asapnow.com. Tweet us if you have an idea. Our handle has changed. It is now at asapnation, or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Ho. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in. So thanks, y'all, and see you next time.